Game on, boyfriend.
Are you about to dispute my official ruling in the sacred tradition of nose goes?
Technically correct.
I should have known. She didn't like me. I don't think anybody likes you.
I like me.
With Tyler Bischoff.
Okay, the zone's not working. They're a little bit too good to cover man to man. And we can't shoot for shit.
On ESPN Las Vegas.
Hello, clown. This show's brand is not exactly hockey. This show's brand is all the stupid stuff that surrounds hockey, like the Golden Knights pregame show. And we need to figure out exactly what our expectations are for this pregame show, how high they should be, because the NHL, here's the thing, the NHL gifted us a season opener in Vegas against the Sharks following the Golden Knights getting eliminated in a seven-game series. That was a seven-game series that featured the Golden Knights blowing a 3-0 lead in Game 7, the Golden Knights blowing a 3-1 series lead, a major penalty that was called that led to the NHL changing their replay review rules, four goals on a single major power play, which is tied for the most successful power play in NHL history. That was all Game 7. Before that, Gerard Gallant called Pete DeBoer a clown. Evander Kane called Ryan Reeves a babysitter. Evander Kane called Ryan Reeves the Muffin Man after they fought. Ryan Reeves compared Joe Thornton to a grandpa, said he needed glasses to see from the press box when he got suspended. Logan Couture lost his teeth to a high stick, and there were Golden Knights fans that thought they were fake teeth on the ice. There is so much material from that series. Before Game 7 happened, there was so much material from that series. It was so full of trash-talking. It was terrific. There are so many dumb references they can make in this pregame show that it needs to be great.
Yeah, and I'm trying to figure out, like, was last year's pregame show a disappointment in order to set up this year's pregame show, which will be like, we're back and we're better than ever.
So, okay, the difference in every other regular season pregame show is there's never really been a need to do a specific to that team pregame show. Like, when they get to the playoffs, they do specific to the team they're playing in that round. But during the regular season, they'll make changes throughout the year, but it's pretty much the same general one, so it's a generic one. This one needs to have references to that series against the Sharks. It should honestly be completely about that. Like, I don't want to see a generic one tonight, even though I have a feeling it'll be.
Are they going to find a helmet in the desert?
I don't know. They did that last year. It can't be in the desert again, right? That is a good question. Where did the helmet go this offseason? Because last year, Alex Ovechkin took it away and buried it in the desert. What did the Sharks do with the Golden Knights helmet this year?
I mean, is it going to be at the bottom of the ocean or something like that?
Lake Mead sticks out of the top because it's not very deep. But I don't know. Yeah,
global warming.
I don't know. Is there a helicopter involved? I don't really know. But like, I specifically, the main thing I want in the pregame show is a reference to the clown comment by Gerard Gallant. Because again, the head coach of one team called the head coach of the other team a clown in a playoff series. And that's like bullet point number 6 when you talk about this series because of what happened in Game 7.
Well, I mean, one coach also said, I've never seen another coach bleep talk player on the ice.
Right.
Like, it's terrific. There's elements that we have to get it that would be incredible by themselves that are footnotes.
Yeah. Like, Pete DeBoer was complaining about Gerard Gallant yelling at Sharks players, and then Gerard Gallant said, for that clown to say that in the paper, first off, that line in itself, the idea that he said in the paper as though like that's the only way Gerard Gallant gets his, it's terrific. It's just like old man calling somebody else a clown. It's so great. It's so wonderful. Like, there's trash talking was between the coaches in that series. So that's what I want to see referenced. I do think they need to somehow involve a referee. They don't need to like kill a referee, but like, just because
they burn a referee in effigy.
Just because there's so much hatred the way that series ended last year, just simply like mentioning a referee will get the angst going, which will be terrific for the pregame video. Will be terrific to get the crowd going, just to simply show somehow a referee and it screwing over Vegas. Like, it'll be terrific. Just the angst that it'll bring will be unbelievable. Just create that by showing a referee or something.
Literally a group of knights are running down a hill with their swords raised high and their, animated sharks going everywhere. And then a guy walks up and goes, "All right, stop. They win."
Be pretty good.
Make everyone go, "Ah, I remember when that happened."
I just am feeling like I'm going to be disappointed, though. My expectations are extremely high for this. I love the corniness, the cheesiness of these things. Like, it just make it as dumb as possible. They cut a freaking plane in half 2 years ago. Like, the Golden Knight was standing on a iceberg in Lake Mead last year fighting off a shark. Like,
and
then
he has magic for
reasons. Oh, yeah, that too. And he didn't use it, though, at the... I don't know. It's very strange. But I love that idea.
He was out of MP.
Please be as cheesy as possible, but please make references to that series against the sharks. Like, that's honestly what I want.
Here's the elements that I always am of two minds about. The knight cutting the plane in half was incredible, because you have an actual guy standing there, and then you have the video of the plane being cut in half projected on the ice. That's incredible. Then there are some elements where it's like, oh, I think that guy who... the two dudes who are fighting on the... like, play fighting on the ice, I don't know if they rehearsed this well, or if that guy just slipped. Because sometimes the live-action stuff isn't as crisp as the, you just stand there with your sword up, and we'll play the video behind you.
Yeah, I think I want more live-action, though. They did a little bit less of it last year, but I think that's... especially when you get the close-up camera shots of the knight, like, shove... like, the first year the knight lost his helmet one time. That was excellent. Because the live-action stuff leads to more errors.
Yes!
Which is... I'm on board for that. One little bit of actual hockey.
All right, well, but before you get to that...
Okay, what do you want?
Giant shark on a wire.
Yes, please.
Flies down, gets cut in half by the knight.
Yes.
And then... the blood is all animated all over the...
Can it be like Sharknado when he sawed the flying shark in half with a chainsaw?
The knight shows up, sets down his sword,
picks up
out
a chainsaw. Yes.
Yes, please.
That would be terrific. Little bit of actual hockey. I think Gerard Gallant is making an excellent call breaking up the top six. I assume he's going to. You don't have Cody Eakin, and you don't have Alex Tuch for the opener. I guess you could have Cody Eakin. He's not on IR. He could actually end up playing. But presumably, you don't have Cody Eakin, you don't have Alex Tuch, which means two-thirds of that presumed third line is gone. The simplest option would be to leave the top six untouched and play Cody Glass as the third line center with Zikov and Peary. But instead, it appears as though they're going to go Cody Glass as the center on the second line with Mark Stone and Max Pacioretty, and they're going to drop Paul Stastny down to the third line with Valentin Zikov and Brandon Peary. Those two lines, by the way, in the last preseason game against the Sharks, they played together. They were the best two lines by Corsi and expected goals for in that game. So one game preseason sample is not that important, but it's the only sample we have. They're pretty good. The question for me, though, is when we get to a healthy Golden Knights roster, which... maybe I shouldn't even make this argument because it's hockey and you're never actually healthy. Like, somebody's always out in hockey, so it's probably never going to happen. But presumably, the Golden Knights, if they're healthy along their forward lines, I still think they might consider breaking up the top six. Because you take Peary or Zikov, and I think either one of those guys is going to shine if you put them on a line with, say, Paul Stastny and Mark Stone, or William Karlsson and Riley Smith, or whatever it is. Like, I think either one of those guys is going to play terrific if you put him with other top six forwards. If he's with Cody Eakin and Alex Tuch, you're probably not getting that much out of Peary or Zikov. So I think when they're fully healthy, there's still probably going to be reasons to break up the top six. There's still probably going to be reasons to drop Riley Smith or Max Pacioretty or Paul Stastny, whatever it is, move those guys around to make the third line actually usable. And honestly, you have to weigh that with how you distribute the minutes among your lines. If you load up the top six, if you leave the Karlsson and the Stastny lines intact as everybody was expecting before the season goes, then you should probably load up your minutes between those two lines as well. You probably shouldn't play your third line very much if that's the case. Now, if you want to distribute your minutes more evenly, then you should distribute your talent a little bit more evenly as well. So we'll see whenever they actually get healthy, but I kind of think breaking up the top six might be in the best interest of down the road when they are healthy. The biggest possible benefit here, though, from the injuries and breaking up the top six, Cody Glass might prove that he can make Cody Eakin expendable. That is important if you look to the future, because Cody Eakin is a free agent after this year, and you want to go into next season knowing whether or not Cody Glass is good enough to play as a second or third line center in the NHL. If you know that he is, Cody Eakin can walk and you're fine with that. If you know that he's not, then you know you have to go find another center to either replace Cody Eakin, or you keep Cody Eakin around, one of the two. So that's probably the biggest benefit here, if we can actually see Cody Eakin play 50, 60 games of the NHL and we figure out, okay, this guy can do it. We can put him on the second line with Stone and Pacioretty or whatever, and he's going to be good. He's going to be fine in the NHL. Or he can't do it. We've got to go find another answer. So that's probably the biggest benefit here to Cody Eakin being hurt to start the year. Granted, Cody Eakin might be back in game two or game three, and then what do you do with Cody Glass then? But hopefully we see Cody Glass a lot, and you sort of get to learn that for the future. And honestly, for this year, you could conceivably trade Cody Eakin. If Cody Glass turns out to be good, you trade Cody Eakin, you save a little bit against the cap, or you go get a player that helps you defensively or wherever you need help more often. One thing I want to do before we go to break. Earlier in the summer, I was on the VGK Insider Show with Ryan Wallace, filling in for Frank, and Ryan had me come up with five bets to make with him. Based on last year when I bet Jesse Granger that Tomas Tatar would outscore William Karlsson, and Tomas Tatar outscored William Karlsson. So here's your refresher on the season opener of the five bets I made with Ryan Wallace. I bet one.
Number five.
Oh, look at you. Prepared. Colin Miller will have more points than Nate Schmidt. So I've got Colin Miller. Ryan's got Nate Schmidt.
Number four.
Erik Brännström, and Oscar Lindberg is in this as well, but he's signed over in Europe somewhere, so he won't actually count.
I think two or three months into the season, someone will call him over.
Brännström and Lindberg will score more points per minute played in the NHL than Mark Stone this year.
Number three.
Jake Bischoff will lead all rookie defensemen in points.
Not feeling good about that one.
Number two.
Malcolm Subban will have a better save percentage than Marc-Andre Fleury.
Yeah, I'd take that right now.
Number one.
Erik Haula and Nikita Gusev will combine to score more goals than Paul Stastny and Max Pacioretty.
So I'd feel pretty confident on like four out of five of those.
Yeah, we'll see. The Brännström, more points per minute than Stone. It really depends on how much the Senators use Brännström. Especially like if they use him if at all on the penalty kill. I don't know how many good defensemen they have there. I assume he's like 5'2". I assume you're not using him on the penalty kill, but he also might be the best player at Ottawa.
He keeps getting hit with the puck because he's so low.
Like he might, like I don't know how good they are, but he might. They might be like, yeah, by default, you're just kind of in there. So we'll see. That's more about how many minutes Erik Brännström ends up playing and how many minutes Mark Stone plays on the penalty kill, because that would be great. Haula and Gusev.
Haula.
It's more goals. Paul Stastny's not going to score a lot, but Gusev's probably not going to score a lot either. It kind of comes down to Pacioretty. If Pacioretty has an awesome season next to Stone, I'll probably end up losing that one. If Pacioretty either stinks or gets moved off that line at some point, then I've got a good chance to win that one. Technically correct. Brought to you by Boyd Gaming. Go to BeConnectedSports.com to download the mobile sports app for quick and easy betting from your phone or tablet. You can bet before the game or while you watch with in-game wagering. It's the Be Connected Sports app from Boyd Gaming.
Check out the podcast on lvsportsnetwork.com.
Visit the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook all season long. Football enthusiasts can catch this year's games with a Monday night viewing party at Bourbon Street Lounge, with giveaways throughout the game, including jerseys. Plus, you can play Las Vegas' longest-running free football contest with $30,000 in guaranteed cash prizes each week. Or place your bets from your phone or tablet with the Be Connected Sports app. Download it at BeConnectedSports.com. Boyd Gaming has you covered for football season.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants.
No, I don't want to go to a party in your pants.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants!
Bischoff's Briefs.
Very well.
The Golden Knights are projected to win the Western Conference.
Before we get to that, I had a suggestion from Papaloo79 on Twitter. How about the ghost of Jerry Tarkanian showing up and biting the head of the San Jose Shark? It's terrific.
I like it. All right. Yeah. Great. That's idea. Good.
So the Athletic had 48 of their writers vote on NHL predictions, and the Golden Knights were picked to win the West with 23 of those 48 votes. The Colorado Avalanche were second. They only had 7. So it's not even close as to who they think will win the West. Vegas far and away the favorite. Only 9, though, picked the Golden Knights to win the Stanley Cup, because 29 picked Tampa Bay. So Tampa Bay far and away the favorite to win the whole thing. Vegas the favorites in the West. No other team got more than 2 votes to win the Stanley Cup. Surprisingly, the Sharks were one of the teams that got 2 votes. But contrast that with the NHL. They pulled 42 players. Only 1 voted for the Golden Knights to win the Stanley Cup.
Hmm.
So the players don't believe in Vegas.
I mean, I assume one of the it was a player for the...
I think Marchessault was one of the players that was pulled.
Okay.
I don't know if they put... They didn't say. I don't know if they put any rules in that says you can't vote for your own team, but he was quoted in the story, so I assume he voted.
Be funny.
If he didn't, yeah. He voted for somebody else. His quote in the story was complimenting Tampa Bay, though. He was talking about how if I had their lineup, you'd be comfortable because they have all the tools. So maybe he voted for Tampa Bay. He's like, yeah, we're good. We'll get there. But yeah, we're not beating those guys.
We're ready for that L. Tyrell Williams missed practice with a foot injury.
Imagine this passing game without Tyrell Williams.
Okay.
The Raiders this year, Tyrell Williams has 216 receiving yards. The rest of the wide receivers have 160.
Oh.
Like, losing Antonio Brown screwed the Raiders in their wide receiver group. Like, they didn't, like, their backup plan was Tyrell Williams, but, like, they don't really have something beyond that.
Do you lose something you got rid of?
That's a good point. But they lost him. Yes. Yes. Throw something into the ocean, you can lose it.
You let it go.
Yeah. So, not having Antonio Brown pushed Tyrell Williams up to 1, and then nobody else is really even a number 2 option as a wide receiver. Darren Waller is actually probably the number 1 option ahead of Tyrell Williams. But, like, the wide receiver group, it's like J.J. Nelson is next in line. Hunter Renfrow actually is the next most yardage, but he's just running 5-yard curls the whole time. Maybe Keelan Doss becomes a better piece. He was the preseason favorite that left to go to Jacksonville, and then the Raiders were like, no, please come back, and we'll put you on the roster now that Antonio Brown's gone. But I don't know. Like, it's just the wide receiver group is just kind of like, okay, Tyrell Williams, we're going to throw you the ball because Darren Waller was covered this time?
I mean, in theory, it's everybody's covered. I'm going to check down.
Nah, he's done. Tyrell Williams is a touchdown in all 4 games.
It's so weird.
And they're actually been like down the... He's not catching at the line of scrimmage. They're running like down the field a little bit. Got to throw it over 10 yards to get to him. One other note, Cleveland Furrell missed practice with a concussion today as well.
Cleveland?
Man, that is brutal.
Furrell. I was so focused on trying to get Furrell, I just whiffed. Is worst rookie pass rusher this season.
The worst. I missed that word in there. This is a tweet from Mike Renner of Pro Football Focus. Among edge rushers with 100 or more pass rushing snaps this season, no one has a lower win rate than Raiders rookie Cleveland Furrell. His win rate is 6.8%. Now, I've told you this before, Pro Football Focus don't always take it as the Bible, but it is a good sort of baseline of understanding. And if he's the worst in the NFL, and it's 6.8% of the time he's winning, it's probably not good.
Fourth overall pick.
The comparisons to other rookies, not to all other players, but to just other rookies. Nick Bosa, who is a rookie edge rusher, his win rate is 24%. Now, granted, he was drafted 2nd. The Raiders had no chance to get him. But Josh Allen, who was picked 7th, 3 spots behind Furrell, his win rate is at 17% this year. Brian Burns, who was drafted 16th overall, his win rate is at 18%. You also have 2 rookie edge rushers that have a higher win rate than Cleveland Furrell does this season. So, are mock drafts always right? No. Are the first 4 games of a guy's NFL career the definition of what he's going to be the rest of the year? No. But there's not much to point to with Cleveland Furrell to say, oh, he will be a good edge rusher in the NFL at some point. Like, I don't know what you would even point to. Like, you're just basically hoping he's really good against the run and becomes average as a pass rusher, but even that still seems like it might not ever happen. And the thing with Cleveland Furrell that's even more sort of, I don't know, annoying. The Raiders draft him at 4 overall. And then in the preseason, they've already decided, well, we're going to move him to the inside on third downs, on passing downs, because we like Arden Key and Max Crosby more to rush the passer. Like, they drafted Max Crosby in the 4th round this year, Arden Key in the 3rd round last year. So, like, when the season starts, you're taking a rookie 4th rounder and a 2nd year 3rd rounder, and they're already better than the guy you drafted 4th overall at edge rushing. It's just, if Ferrell had been taken at 24 or 27, okay, like, the slow start isn't as big of a deal. The reduced use on the outside isn't as big of a deal. But the fact that you had the 4th overall pick and you trust your 3rd and 4th round picks from the last couple of years more than him is like, okay, it's just going to be an underwhelming 5 years of Cleveland Ferrell.
Well, just also, they could have gotten what? They could have gotten Ed Oliver. They could have
got Josh Allen.
Yeah.
I mean, Brian Burns went 16th. They could have traded out of 4 and had like more picks and taken him at 16 or something.
They could have recreated this to be a havoc offensive line, and it's our defensive line. And
we tackle Marlon Mack.
The Raiders have a 17% chance to make the playoffs.
Higher than I expected. That is according to 538.com. Their record, projected record, is 7-9. Also, better than I expected. According to 538, there are 3 AFC teams that are picked to not win their division and finish 9-7. And those, 2 of those 3 would end up being the wild card teams. It's Cleveland, LA Chargers, and Buffalo. Then there are 3 more teams that are projected to be 8-8. So the Raiders at 7-9 is not far away from the playoffs if the last playoff team is 9-7, but there's a whole lot of teams in between you and that last playoff spot, because at 7-9, that would be projected to be the 11th best record in the AFC. 6 make the playoffs. So not actually that close when you look at how many teams you have to pass. But I will say this, if you're the Raiders and you're looking at this year as a rebuilding, you're looking at the John Gruden era, he's got to rebuild from scratch. Partially because he traded away all the good players, but you've got to rebuild from scratch. Last year, you win 4 games, and for the most part, you weren't competitive in the majority of your losses. If you get to 7 wins this year, like, that's a good track as far as rebuilding goes. It's not great for getting good draft picks.
Yeah, that's part of the problem.
But if you're looking at it as, well, we're going to waste it on Cleveland Ferrell anyways, going from 4-7 is a good track, and especially the more competitive part of it, because last year the point differential was horrific.
I mean, they also wasted it on trading Pittsburgh a bunch of late round picks and then cutting the guys that they get.
Yeah, I don't blame the trade so much. I mean, it is a 3rd and a 5th. Like, I guess they could have gotten another Max Crosby.
Well, wouldn't
or something.
It be? Isn't it 2/3? What they get for what they trade for the White Tiger?
Oh, you're talking about Martavis Bryant. Yeah, that was a bad one. That was the Antonio Bryant or Antonio Brown one. You absolutely trade a 3rd and a 5th for him. Even if it turns out he's insane and you can't actually keep him because he's terrifying to everybody, you absolutely trade a 3rd and a 5th for Antonio Brown. But the Martavis Bryant one, that was that a 3rd? I'm confused with him and the A.J. McCarron trade. One was a 3rd, one was a 5th.
What was the one?
And neither
for,
one was very good.
What was the, was it Ryan Grant that they also traded for?
I think that was a 7th, which, okay. Whatever. Get the 7ths out of here. But ultimately, you finish with 7 wins. That's pretty good as far as improvement, though I do think, I don't know if there's anything to back this up, but I would assume when you're rebuilding, the easiest step is going from terrible to right below average, which is basically what 4 wins last year to 7 wins this year would be. Like, I mean, just take Tony Sanchez. He pretty quickly got from, you know, 2 wins every year to, well, we're going to win 4 at least. Like, that happened rather quickly. It's been that next step from 4 to 6 that's been tough. And I think John Gruden, it'll probably, if they get to 7 this year, it'll be that next step from getting to 7 to 9 or 10 that's going to be the difficult part.
Derek Carr has the 4th shortest depth of target in the NFL.
A tweet from PFF Steve. Lowest average depth of target on completions. Mason Rudolph, 3.4. Teddy Bridgewater, 3.4. Jacoby Brissett, 4.7. Derek Carr, 4.9. So the average completion for Derek Carr only travels 4.9 yards in the air down the field, and all the other quarterbacks shorter than that are backups. I mean, Brissett's the starter, but he became the starter because Andrew Luck retired. What's interesting to me on that, you take Mason Rudolph and Teddy Bridgewater, and they come in for injured quarterbacks, and the game plan gets shifted to, we're just going to get it to our playmakers as soon as we possibly can. The Saints went to Seattle in Teddy Bridgewater's first start, and it was, here Michael Thomas, here Alvin Kamara, we're getting you the ball at the line of scrimmage. go make people miss. And it worked in Seattle. And if you watch the Steelers on Monday night, it was James Conner and Jalen Samuels. We're going to wildcat to Jalen Samuels. We're going to throw it. I think they both had 8 catches in that game. Like, the plan for both those teams was, we've got pretty good skill position, guys. Let's just get them the ball as quick as possible.
Okay. I found this stat out. For that game, James Conner and Samuels had a negative depth of target.
Probably, yeah, yeah.
For the game.
Yeah, no, Mason Rudolph's depth of target was negative two, or his average depth of target was like negative 1 yards.
Yeah.
Yeah, so like it absolutely was. I believe that. But that's the game plan. The problem, when you compare that to Carr, those are backup quarterbacks. Those are coaches making adjustments to say, okay, how do we pick up this load? Derek Carr's the bleeping starter. Like, it's not like Mike Glennon came in and they're like, all right, we got to get the ball to Jacobs and Waller as quick as we can. No. This is happening, and this is what
he's
the plan was.
He's not capable of.
This is what the plan was. So it's depressing. So, whatever. We have Shang Peng coming up next. It's going to be a lot of fun when we talk to Shang. Totally correct. We've got a new sponsor. We are brought to you by Michael E. Menden Diamond Jewelers in the Fashion Show Mall. Are you looking for the best way to show off your love of the Golden Knights? Michael E. Menden Diamond Jewelers has the largest selection of officially licensed Golden Knights jewelry with watches, cufflinks, bracelets, and more. Get yours today. Michael E. Menden Diamond Jewelers is where Las Vegas buys diamonds and engagement rings and is your home for officially licensed Raiders and Golden Knights jewelry.
Haven't you been dating the same girl for like 8 years?
Aren't you supposed to be going to break?
I'm just saying, like, in the last... All right, so we get this diamond, you get this diamond endorsement, and then yesterday you're all talking to Cassie Soto about proposals. Are you?
No.
Okay. All right.
I wouldn't tell you anyways if I was.
I find out by the invitation.
We had Desiree Francois on a while ago, and she was pressuring me into getting engaged. This is ridiculous. Everything is conspiring against me to get engaged now. 8 years isn't that long.
You're listening to Technically Correct with Tyler Bischoff, brought to you by Boyd Gaming.
There's a twist on it.
It did.
A twist,
it,
and it's
it turned it around.
We should have thought of that.
We were so...
But it's still a stupid
It's such
cover.
A fine line between stupid and clever.
Yeah, it's just clever. A little turnabout.
Tyler Bischoff is Technically Correct.
If you recall, during the playoffs, we had Shang Peng on our show pretty much every day during that series, but only for 2 minutes. We've made a slight adjustment to this Shang Peng segment, but we are bringing it back. Here we go.
Belsky was dropped, and Cody Eakin's going to get 5 in the game here.
How confident are you the Sharks will make the playoffs this year, Shang?
95%.
95? That's pretty high.
That's pretty high. I think Eric Carlson will stay healthy. I think Martin will be average this year. So I think that he'll be all right.
Was the Sharks Golden Knights the best first round series in NHL history?
Yes, I believe so. And I spoke with a number of reporters about it while it was happening. And we were all in, to quote Fred Durst, that it probably was the best first-round series that we watched.
So you talked to people while it was happening, and they said that. So they said that before Game 7 even happened.
Not before Game 7 necessarily, but after Game 7, and even during, too, though, because there's a lot of stuff happening during. I mean, the morning of Game 7, Gerard Gallant going off on Peter DeBoer, that we knew that we were there for something special.
I'm disappointed Game 7 happened because we kind of forget that Gerard Gallant called DeBoer a clown.
Well, we forget a lot of things because of so much that happened. We forgot about Tommy Hertl making a pseudo guarantee. Hey, beat it.
Is Evander Kane a dirty player?
He definitely is on the edge. He has made dirty plays from time to time, but I wouldn't call him by and large a dirty player, though. I don't think that's his rep around the league. But definitely on the edge, though.
Did you think he deserved a suspension for what happened in the preseason game on Sunday?
Yes, you can't touch the official, even if there's extenuating circumstances. And I think the NHL did take some of those extenuating circumstances and limit the penalty. I mean, we saw that hack that Kane took that hit the linesman first. But it was definitely directed toward England. Just the linesman got in the way. The NHL could have taken a less kinder eye, less tolerant eye toward that splash. So it could have been a 10-plus.
You tweeted out something about this, but do you think we'll ever get anything from the NHL about the linesman who basically injected himself into the play and tackled Evander Kane?
What do you think, Tyler?
No, I mean, I know what the answer is. Why are they so scared to say things, Shang?
I mean, they don't want guys to look bad. I understand with refereeing a little bit, too. Like, if you put that out there, good or bad, like, the fans will react to it. And so I think that they want the referees to be as under the radar as possible, which, of course, is not what happened. This is not what the linesman, Kyle Merchison, did that night between Kane and England. But I think that's the desire on both sides, and I understand that.
What did you think of Kane saying that he thinks he's being treated or targeted unfairly by the NHL?
Well, there's definitely a tone, like he's sort of implying a racism there. I'm not going to go as far as saying that, so I want to make that clear. But definitely, though, there is racism in hockey. That same day, we had a Chicago Blackhawks announcer saying of a player on the Berlin team that they're playing exhibition, his name, last name was Ortega. The Chicago Blackhawks announcer, Pat Foley, said, "Hey, Ortega, that ought to be a shortstop name." So don't tell me that there isn't subtle racism in hockey.
Shang, bringing the heat in this short segment. Do you think Evander Kane, when he plays the Golden Knights, do you think he hurts the Sharks more than he actually helps them?
Well, I think at this point we've looked at the track record, and yes, so far I guess you can say that, but Evander is such a good player, and I believe in regression, things going back to the average, and so I would always put him in the lineup, and the goals will start coming for him in Vegas, just obviously not tonight.
Who hates refs more, Evander Kane or Golden Knights fans?
I'm going to still go Golden Knights fans. I mean, that was a playoff game. That was a game 7 you guys had in hand. So,
Do other teams get under? Not good. Who wins in a fight? Who wins in a fight, Gerard Gallant or Pete DeBoer?
Oh, Gallant for sure. I mean, come on. I mean, look at those guys. Not even a question.
Well,
not even a question.
What about endurance?
So Gallant had seasons of like 200-plus penalty minutes in NHL.
That's no hot. Fighting in hockey's not real fighting, though.
Okay. Yeah, I guess so. At this point, Peter might be in slightly better shape, so I might give you that. But no, Gallant still got the puncher's chance. So.
Yeah, you just run around, and Gallant's tired. You can't just laugh, Shane. You can't just laugh. How good do you think the Golden Knights are?
They are my pick for the division. They're super deep at forward. They've lost Cody Eakin, and they lost Alex Tuck for the start of the season. You see, they can just throw out, we'll throw out Cody Glass, you know, and we'll try him out with our best players. And it's probably going to work out. And so they're very deep at forward. They obviously still have Marc-Andre. Their defense is, as always, a little bit of a question, but they've made it work. It's been a workmanlike defense, no big names, but they've made it work the last couple of years. Obviously, Shea Theodore is better than ever, too. So I think this is a very good team.
Is it good enough to win the Stanley Cup, though?
Yeah. Why wouldn't it be?
Because it's hockey. What do you mean, why wouldn't it be? Because they finished, they had the 15th most points in the NHL last year.
Yeah, but I think they're definitely a good enough team to win the Stanley Cup. I mean, they're probably at somebody at the deadline, too.
They don't have any cap space. What are you talking
about? They are good enough to win the Stanley Cup.
How are they adding someone at the deadline with no cap space?
They'll have cap space by the time we get there, so.
What is that? You sound like George McPhee. Don't worry about it. We'll have it.
It's a cap explanation. I'll take longer than 5 minutes.
So I just hung up on him.
That's what we're supposed to do.
Yeah. I always feel bad about that
part.
Yeah,
you should. It's okay. I'll tell him. He'll be there tonight. I'll say hello to him.
Okay.
Feel bad. So that was Shang Peng from Fear the Fin. He got me on one of those.
Oh man, he walked you right into it. I was warning you over here.
That was good. If you're unaware of what just happened there.
Blew a lead thanks to a 5-minute major.
Yeah, we had Shang Peng on during the playoffs and did 2 minutes with him just to have Shang Peng on every day and do something stupid like that. Today we decided to do 5 for obvious reasons, and if you don't know, we played 4 goal horns during that. They might have aligned with a certain exact time of 4 goals being scored in a certain playoff game. I don't know if I needed to explain that, but I wanted to explain that because I was very proud of that idea when I came up with it. All right, We need to do this as much as possible because it is one of the best things that we do on this show. And I'm sure even if you heard it yesterday, you are dying to hear it again. Jake Bischoff needs to play for the Golden Knights.
Are you still blaming referees for your playoff elimination? Are you relying on the same 37-year-old solution to your problems? Are you about to use another defenseman that can't skate just because he is tall? Then it is time to ask your AHL coach about Jake Bischoff. Jake Bischoff is ready to stop any major problem before it happens. Best of all, Jake Bischoff doesn't cost $2.2 million. Just think of all the Russians you can mismanage with that extra cash. With Jake Bischoff, you won't have to watch fourth liners skate around your defensemen in overtime.
Pass picked off at center ice by Erik Karlsson. In he comes. Throws it ahead. Good point alone.
Give Jake Bischoff a try, and you won't lose three straight closeout games ever again. Jake Bischoff, the number one defensive enhancement.
A couple of people on Twitter weren't thrilled that we used the Sharks game-winning goal call in Game 7 there. That's the whole point! I'm trying to convey that the Golden Knights need better defensemen. They need defensive enhancement. The whole point is to say the Golden Knights defensemen aren't good enough, and Braden McNabb, supposed to be one of the best defensemen on this team, getting dusted by a fourth liner. Barclay freaking Goodrow scored the game-winning goal in overtime.
Yeah.
Like, that's what happened. That awesome series ended in Game 7 because Barclay Goodrow scored. Like, William Carrier scoring the game-winner for the Golden Knights in overtime. Not Jonathan Marchessault or William Karlsson or Mark Stone. No. Barclay freaking Goodrow scored the game-winner because Braden McNabb got skated around. And Erik Karlsson made a really good pass. By the way, I did not realize this until I was going back to watch the highlights to get the audio for that. Mark Stone turned the puck over that led to that goal.
Uh-huh.
He threw a pass out to center ice that Erik Karlsson picked off, and Erik Karlsson passed it to Goodrow, who skated around McNabb and scored. So, yeah, that's not ideal.
Not good.
Like, we haven't put, Mark Stone getting... There has been zero blame placed on the Golden Knights for losing that series.
I mean, I feel like I've given them lots of blame Okay.
I should say, from Golden Knights fans, there's been zero blame.
Don't let up that many goals in 5 minutes. You'll be fine.
That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the overtime one.
Oh, okay.
They technically survived that because they scored to tie the game and send it to overtime.
Yeah, then win in overtime.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
There's been, zero discussion of that
goal. Both teams can get the puck.
Goal happening. Braden McNabb getting dusted by a fourth liner and Mark Stone turning the puck over. Can't do that.
No.
And the funny part of that is the Golden Knights tried to trade for Erik Karlsson 1 year, didn't get him, so they get Mark Stone the next year.
I mean,
we got UNLV basketball news. Donnie Tillman, he's eligible.
Get in touch with the show on Twitter at @Bischoff_Tyler.
A very big sports story is happening.
Tyler Bischoff is...
If a very big sports story was happening, we'd know it.
We do know it. We just don't understand it.
You don't understand it.
Technically correct.
UNLV football update first. Mark Anderson tweets, UNLV football rested Armani Rogers today and gave Kenyon Oblad the first team reps, with Max Gillum getting the second team reps. Will be game time decision on the starter. So Gillum is coming back from injury. He should be able to play, but it's a matter of he hasn't done anything. He's had a leg injury for a while, so I doubt you'd actually see Max Gillum unless it's an emergency situation. But talked about it yesterday, if Armani Rogers is not 100% with his ankle, you do not play him. Like, if he can't run at 100%, there's no competitive reason to play him, and you can make the argument, oh, he might get hurt more. So, but just from a purely trying to win the game, if Armani Rogers can't run at 100%, you don't play him. Now, on basketball news, UNLV got huge news yesterday. Donnie Tillman cleared by the NCAA. He will be eligible to play this season for UNLV. He transferred in from Utah. His mother's sick, and I assume that was part of the reason why he won this appeal for immediate eligibility. He was the Pac-12 Sixth Man of the Year last year, over 10 points per game. But this is massive for this year's team. He and Amori Hardy should form a pretty solid duo in the Mountain West. It doesn't make UNLV really a Mountain West contender, but I think UNLV, it's fair to say they should sort of be in that 4-6 range in the Mountain West, 3-6 range, we'll see. I mean, San Diego State, Nevada are probably the 2 and 3 behind Utah State, but I don't think either one of them is that terrifying. It seems, I don't know, I feel too optimistic. Because like I'm saying, oh, they're in the 3-6 range, which means, oh, they could finish third. They can't finish third, right?
I mean, maybe if...
I don't know. I mean, I expect them to be top three Mountain West as an offensive unit. And I guess the question is, are they an average defensive unit? Because if they're an average defensive unit, then okay, they might finish third. If they're the worst defensive team in the Mountain West...
Who do you have as 1 and 2?
Utah State's 1. Nevada, San Diego State are probably going to be 2 and 3. They've probably got the second and third best rosters.
Do we think Nevada's just going to keep chugging?
Their roster's very good.
Okay.
It's not as good top 10 in the country like Eric Musselman had last year, but it's still, Mountain West-wise, a very good roster.
Okay.
New Mexico has a good roster, but this show doesn't believe in Paul Weir. And then Boise State and Air Force, Fresno State, that's sort of where UNLV belongs. So... could they be better than all those teams? Yeah. Could they be worse than all those teams? I guess. But I think they'll be a little bit better. Now, Donnie Tillman. We have this quote from TJ Altzelberger yesterday talking about Donnie Tillman and the type of game that he plays offensively.
Donnie's a dream come true from an analytics standpoint. His ability to draw fouls, shoot the basketball, finish at the rim. He's a guy that doesn't settle very often for those mid-range shots that kind of go against what the analytics say. He's tremendous, and it's very valuable to have guys with that skill set.
Did it move?
I have never had a quote made me love a player more than that. An analytics dream come true because he doesn't shoot mid-range jumpers.
Well, what about the coach saying, like, oh, I love this guy. He doesn't shoot mid-range jumpers.
It's the best thing I've ever heard.
Like this is like sports Viagra.
It's the second week of fall practice, and Altzelberger is already like, yeah, this guy's mid-range jumpers. He doesn't shoot him. Some actual numbers for you on it. Last year, 9% of Tillman's shots were mid-range jumpers. Comparison, South Dakota State last year under Altzelberger, 19% of their shots were mid-range jumpers. UNLV, 35% of their shots were mid-range jumpers. So if you just compare it to the Marvin Menzies era, much better, much more improved as far as taking the analytically smart shot. I think here's what I'm curious about. If you took what Marvin Menzies' expected roster was going to be this year and compare it to what Altzelberger has, it's pretty comparable. I think you'd give Menzies probably end up having a little bit more depth, and he'd likely have Shakur Justin, which would push them over the edge because they'd have Tomboy, Hardy, and Justin. They'd have kind of a big three, whereas UNLV kind of only has a big two. But I think there's a chance UNLV ends up being better simply because of math. Simply because, like, you're replacing Joel Tomboy, who was the worst offender in terms of taking pull-up mid-range jumpers when you didn't have to. Like, when there's 20 seconds on the shot clock just because he could take them. You replace him with Donnie Tillman, who's never going to take that type of shot, and you replace the coach with a coach that actually believes in, hey, we don't want to take those mid-range jumpers. They're bad. We're going to score more points if we shoot threes or get to the rim. I think they've got it. They'll be more efficient on offense. I think both teams were going to be bad defensively at the end of the day. Last point on Tillman, though. If you look at this team and you look at what sort of Altzelberger, what types of players you need to do what Altzelberger wants, I think the two most important types of players they have on the roster. I think number one, you need a ball handler that can get into the lane or off of pick and rolls or on their own. Like, you need somebody that can break down a defense, because if you have all this spacing, you have all these shooters, it's useless if nobody can break down the defense, because then you can just stay glued to the shooters. But so you need somebody to get in the lane. That's Amori Hardy. They have that. I'm expecting a big leap from him. We'll see how efficient he actually is at distributing from that role, but they have that in Amori Hardy. David Jenkins will be that player next year. The other type of player you need is someone that can play power forward or center or both and can shoot threes. That's what Donnie Tillman is, because when you have that, you will always have four shooters on the floor. You will always have good spacing around the Amori Hardy type that's getting into the lane. Even with Mbaki Zhang out there at center, you can still find a way to hide him and still space the floor with one non-shooter. If you have two, it becomes very, very difficult. But with Donnie Tillman, now all of a sudden you have a guy that can defend other power forwards, and on the offensive end, he shoots threes. On the offensive end, he gives you the spacing he needs. He's that 6'6 to 6'9 guy that can shoot. So he's got the two most important pieces. Go win.
Yo, suck it,
Tyler!